Welcome to the Actionable Futurist podcast, a show all about the near-term future with practical and actionable advice from a range of global experts to help you stay ahead of the curve. Every episode answers the question, what's the future of? With voices and opinions that need to be heard. Your host is international keynote speaker and actionable futurist Andrew Grill.
My guest today is Phil Sorsky, Senior Vice President of Service Provider Sales in EMEA for CommScope. Phil is responsible for all business in the telecommunications space, including mobility and fixed line. He has more than 20 years of telecommunications industry experience, having worked for Juniper Networks, Adobe Systems, Cisco Systems, and AT&T. And he's a graduate of the University of Birmingham in the UK. So for people who don't know about CommScope, what do you do?
We basically provide the plumbing for the internet, whether that be fixed line in terms of fiber and or copper DOCSIS style of infrastructure, as well as wireless infrastructure. On the wireless side, for example, at the RAN site, we do everything except the radio. So all of the antennas, the cabling, the filters and so on is all typically purchased from CommScope.
Now, I saw another interview you did, and I didn't realize this, but you actually own the Andrew antenna brand.
That's right. We acquired Andrew, I think it was around about 2008. And of course, Andrew, although we've been involved in modern RAN systems throughout 1G, 2G, 3G, Andrew goes back a lot further than that. I think right back to about the 1930s, you'll see our old antennas at the top of the Empire State Building.
They're very distinctive. As a radio engineer years ago in Australia, that distinctive red lightning bolt was something that I always looked up at. And I'm the geek that looks up at microwave towers to see what frequency they're using. But hey, that's a whole other story.
I'm the other one. I bore my wife every time we see one of our satellite dishes. I say, look, there's another red flash.
We're here to talk about a number of things. One is the digital divide, which is an interesting thing to talk about, especially sort of as we're coming out of pandemic and people are now relying more on communications. So with the lines between home and office increasingly being blurred due to the rise of remote and distributed working, access to reliable connectivity is really crucial so that local economies and communities can truly thrive. I read a recent report from Ofcom that showed 1.5 million homes in the UK are still without efficient broadband. So my question to you is, what can be done to narrow this digital divide, especially since we're now relying on online services even more as a result of the pandemic?
I think this phrase digital divide is actually an interesting phrase because it's become a common phrase that we all use. But I would define digital divide as people who don't have access to the internet or reasonable access to the internet. Now, I would suggest that everybody who works in an office that needed to work from home through the pandemic either already had or soon acquired a decent broadband connection, because otherwise they couldn't do their job. But they're not the people that, at least when digital divide was originally defined, as the haves and the have-nots, they, to me, are not the people that are being left behind. The people that are being left behind are the ones that don't have access to a basic internet connection. And by definition, those people are not going to be people who were working in an office. I would suggest that maybe, educationally, they didn't get a great start in life. They didn't get a great chance at the very beginning. And as society moves more online, and as most people do have access to not so much dial-up these days, but fixed broadband, even as low as, say, 256K or 512K, but as most people do have access to some kind of broadband link, the ones being left behind are the very poor, and the people who didn't get a chance to get a good education. And fixing that, to me, it's as much of a political problem as it is a technology problem. And I guess there was a lot of hoo-ha at the last election in the UK as to whether there should be free broadband for all. Well, I don't prescribe to that at all, because if you can afford to pay for something, which I can, you can, then why should the government subsidise that? Because that's money that could be going to the NHS or to local council services or whatever. But for those people that really can't afford some kind of connection, a broadband connection, then I think that is the role of government. So I'm not suggesting for one second free broadband for all. I would say in well over 90% of cases, people should pay for it, just like they pay for Sky TV and so on. But there is that section of society that is going to need supporting. If we're going to be able to move everything online and everybody's going to live in the cloud and so on, and all government services will be accessible via the cloud, then we can't leave behind that section of society that didn't get a great start. And I think there is a role for government to provide some kind of backstop for them, if you like, in the same way we do for food and for healthcare.
I saw during the pandemic that a lot of the mobile operators were providing low or free services to people that were vulnerable. And I think also NHS workers actually got access to extra data or unlimited data as well. So the mobile operators also saw how important this was. So I suppose when we talk about broadband, we often think about a fixed connection. But can new services like 5G solve this last mile problem?
In short, yes, it can. If you live in a place that doesn't have decent fixed broadband, but you can get that wireless signal, then 5G can certainly do the job. I was unfortunate enough to watch Liverpool at West Ham last weekend, and we lost 3-2, so it wasn't a great experience. But whilst waiting before the game, I just tested my download speed, and I pulled down Ookla near the stadium at the Olympic Stadium, and I was getting 200 megabits per second on 5G. And for a geek like me, I think, wow, 200 meg wirelessly in the middle of the East End is absolutely incredible. But I would suggest that, unfortunately, a lot of the places that don't have good fixed broadband don't have access to good wireless either, because fundamentally, you still need to run fiber from that place, wherever that place may be, back into the core network. And if that place is, let's say, a remote Scottish island or somewhere deep into the countryside that no telco has run fibre to a point of presence, then no amount of wireless connectivity is going to give you that high-speed internet, because the wireless world, sooner or later, has to be connected to the wired world, which in this day and age is fibre. So unfortunately, I think the places with bad coverage are often ones without good fixed or wireless broadband, in which case 5G isn't going to particularly help.
Well, I'm a former telco engineer and worked for Telstra and Optus in Australia, as you know. So if we were having this discussion in Australia, the Telstra people would be laughing at you, because they reach some of the most remote places in the world with fibre. I laugh sometimes because I'm not sure if you're aware, but the UK could fit into Australia 42 times. So it's actually quite tiny when you look at the landmass of Australia. And when you say there are some parts that don't have coverage, the media famously talks about not spots, places where there's no mobile coverage. And you're absolutely right. With these 5G services, the fact that you can get 200 megabits a second on a handheld, that has to get to a base station, that has to get there via fibre. So obviously the East End of London is well covered. But how do we balance the digital divide? And what's the latest in the UK with fibre and wireless connectivity in those rural and hard to reach areas? BT are ramping things up. What's the limit? Where will we get to?
The good news is that certainly from a BT point of view, they are extending their tentacles deeper into the UK footprint. And as you say, to BT, going 50 or 60 miles off piste is a long way. And in Australian terms, that's around the corner. We work a lot with NBN, the big Australian carrier, and that is literally still in the local neighbourhood in Australian terms. But I think when it comes to BT, they are going deeper and deeper into the rural footprint, as it were. A, because they see a business opportunity, and B, there is more government pressure than ever now for BT to step up and provide universal coverage across the UK in the same way, if you like, as the post office. When the post office first came to the fore many years ago, they had to offer a service to everybody in the country. And I think finally BT are getting with it from that perspective. I was in deepest Wales about 9 months ago with my wife, and I was surprised to see an Openreach van trundling down the lane. And as we stopped, the guy stopped and was about to get a cassette to put at the pole. And we had a good conversation about, what are you doing? He said, well, I'm installing fibre to the home, aren't I? And this was right in the middle of nowhere from a UK point of view. So, yeah, I think it's getting a lot better, and it will continue to get better. What I can't say is happening that quickly is the alternates. The alternate carriers that are putting fibre in, whether that be Virgin, O2 at the very high level, or some of the other alternates like City Fibre, they will cherry pick. They will go after where can they get the most homes connected quickly. And of course, a farm down the end of a lane in Norfolk isn't going to be as attractive to them as doing downtown Norwich would be, for example. So I think for commercial reasons, they'll be slower to that that very remote location.
Well, I wanted to talk about community fibre for a moment, because I've had G.network dig up the street outside my home, and they're doing it all over here in South Kensington. And it just seems to me a very expensive way of connecting people. So they lay the fibre, and then obviously they would hopefully go door to door and try and connect people up. I've got friends in Fulham, though, that for people not from London is not very far. It's about a half an hour walk or a 10-minute drive from here. And one street is being laid. The parallel street where my friend lives, they need £5,000 up front before they'll even consider laying fibre down the next street. So you're right that they're cherry picking. What is the opportunity here for community fibre? Will we really see areas where there is decent fibre? Will every home be connected in, say, 10 years' time?
I think the answer is yes. Interestingly, you know, one of the reasons I say yes is that the carriers are all digging up the streets, as you say. You can't get around London these days without having to navigate all kinds of roadworks for that very reason. The government is pushing hard, not just on BT, but on all the telcos to make it happen. But that coincided with COVID and the pandemic. And like, you know, I liken COVID to a war. And in all wartime, some terrible things happen, some very sad things happen. But also some things are extremely accelerated, if you like. So, you know, going back to World War II, things like penicillin were really pushed to the fore. Penicillin had been invented, but it wasn't really being used. Whereas in World War II, the military realized if they could inject penicillin to, give penicillin rather, to all of their soldiers, it made their army more robust. And it massively accelerated the mass production of penicillin. And I think broadband has gone through a similar curve. Before COVID, there were people like me and, dare I say, you, the more geeky end of society that absolutely wanted the fastest speed, and other people that would just always choose the fastest speed available because that's the kind of personality they are. But a lot of other people were not that bothered about the speed they were getting until suddenly they were working from home and they could see both the visual and the audio difference that a decent broadband connection made. And so all of these things happening at the same time is forcing people to see not just the need for an internet connection, which I think everybody had jumped on that bandwagon by 2008 or 2009, but now everybody is conscious, particularly if you have an office type of job or a job that you can do from a computer. And if you have that kind of job, everybody now realizes the importance of a decent broadband connection, as well as anybody with children, anybody who's had to suffer their children being at home on and off for the last 22 months or whatever, also realize that once you've got three or four children coming home from school, whether it's because they're doing their homework or they're doing some kind of online gaming, but suddenly when their broadband speeds crash because they're also trying to run an office Teams call or a Zoom call or whatever, they realize how important broadband is. That's tied in with, you know, if you talk to estate agents, there's been a massive surge in interest and, in fact, sales of property much further away from London than there typically was before the pandemic. I'm not from the southeast of England, like you're not. You're from a bit further away than I am. But coming from Liverpool, in the 80s, everything revolved around London, and you had to be in or around the home counties to be involved on a national or international scale. Whereas now, with decent broadband, you can literally work from anywhere. You can't do that without decent broadband. And so the way politics works, the wealthier people, the more articulate people and so on, they're in a position to influence large companies like BT and or politicians like the current government to make sure that broadband is rolled out to suit their needs. And if their needs that they've bought a country pile down on the Cornwall Devon border, then they can pull the levers to make that happen more so than when they didn't care 3 or 4 years ago. So I, you know, long-winded answer to your question, I guess, I do think that the proliferation of fibre is going to take place such that everybody almost who wants it within reason will have fibre to their home by certainly the end of this decade and probably a lot sooner.
That's a bold prediction. You're too right about the connectivity, the fact that the pandemic has really focused that. I reckon in a not too different future, the Zooplas of this world, the sort of house finding networks, they might even say, what's the estimated speed, broadband speed you'll get to this home? Is there fibre in the street? Because that's an important consideration. Even if you've got fast broadband, once everyone gets on there, it's then your home network that suffers. Some years ago, I moved to a Unify system, which is a professional grade wireless network. And friends who've said I've got bad Wi-Fi, I've actually now installed that in 9 different houses, including my parents in Australia. And I remotely manage these 9 Wi-Fi networks and balance things to get great speed. So I know exactly how that's increased.
Can we make that 10?
I'd love to help you. Yes. You mentioned the National Broadband Network, the NBN in Australia, and that's quite an interesting topic because back in 2007, The government of the day, I think it was the Labor government, said, we are going to connect everyone to fibre. Fast forward through subsequent Conservative and Labor governments, it all became very difficult to do because they realised, especially in a country like Australia, connecting every home to fibre is actually quite difficult. The fast forward in technology, the fact that it's now easy to lay fibre, the fact the demand is now there, the fact that we're doing lots of video calls and we've got Netflix and Amazon Prime and the demand on that is so much greater, people are now seeing that they need to move and move up to the speed. Do you think having the government mandate that everyone be connected to fibre will help? I mean, you alluded to it there. Would the NBN-style system work here in the UK?
I think, first of all, at NBN, the vision was great. And I fully endorse where the then Labour government in Australia was coming from in terms of the importance and the need to provide fibre to every home. Unfortunately, like a lot of things in life, I think NBN became a little bit of a political football in terms of whether it was funded, whether it was not. As each new government was coming up for election, NBN didn't know even if it would exist post-election because of how they're going to be carry on funding and so on. And that doesn't help at all. Secondly, NBN, it didn't start with a greenfield opportunity. It acquired various components of what it had, some Telstra assets and some Doxis cable TV type assets and so on. It kind of had to make the best job of what it had inherited. And of course, if you take Doxis over cable TV, that is a way of providing high-speed internet into a home. And at the time, if you look at the as technology has moved on since 2007, through 2007, 8, 9, 10, using Doxis was probably one of the most affordable ways to provide high-speed internet to a large part of the then NBN footprint. So, if it's going to cost you $1,000 or $2,000 to connect a home versus a few hundred or even just a few tens of dollars on Doxis, you'd go down the lower cost route to be able to connect more homes quickly. However, in the long run, I would say that was somewhat short-sighted. It might have been economically wise. And as I say, because it's a political football, you couldn't criticize anybody in NBN for how they've gone about things. But in the long run, fiber will always win. For the simple reason that whether you look at Doxis over cable TV networks or DSL over Twisted Pair, they're both copper-based. And they were both designed, in the case of coax, to run TV signals, in the case of Twisted Pair, to run voice, human voice. And they did a great job for many decades. It was only human ingenuity that found a way to transmit high-speed data over cable TV cables, and human ingenuity that invented DSL to run high-speed data over an analog copper cable. But they were never designed to do that in the first place, whereas fiber was. Fiber was invented to run high-speed data in a cost-effective way. So in the end, and when I say in the end, I'm sort of fast forward 50 to 100 years from now, they'll look back at the equivalent of the Victorians, if you like, when we used to run data over copper networks, because in the end, it'll all be over fiber, because that's what it was designed to do.
Showing my age, and when I present, I had a presentation last week to a bunch of lawyers, actually, and I explained that I've been online since 1983. And I asked for a show of hands, who in the room was born after that? And there were quite a few people. And I said, I've actually been online longer than you've been alive. And I played the dial-up tone. And I remember dialing up to a bulletin board system in 1983 at 300, that's 300 bits per second. Not megabits, not kilobits, 300 bits per second. And that was painful. But I remember when I was at Telstra and I was an executive, so I got to have two bonded ISDN channels. So I had 128 kilobits a second at home and I thought I was in heaven. Could you put a figure on the societal benefits of connection and good, reliable connection, both economically and socially?
I'm not sure I could put a figure on it, to be honest. The last 20 months have proven that whether it be from a business point of view, a career point of view, or from a social point of view, that without connectivity, we would have been in big trouble. I've had this conversation many times as society's opened up and we've been able to meet friends and so on. And I've asked the question, can you imagine what would have happened in the last 2 years if we hadn't have had broadband? And by the way, the broadband we have today is nowhere near as good as it's going to be in the next 5 years. But even with the broadband we have, even if you've only got, say, 5 or 10 meg or whatever, can you imagine what would have happened to society if we didn't have that broadband, both from a mental health point of view in terms of being able to at least maintain some social contact, but more importantly, from an economic point of view, the fact that a lot of us, anybody with, as I say, with a role that can be done via a computer, in the main, we could carry on working from home. And if we hadn't have had that broadband connectivity, then one of two things would have happened. Either the economy would have collapsed, a la World War II style of collapse, or we would have had to accept a much higher death toll than we had, albeit it was awful and probably too high, as it were. But it would have been a lot worse had we not had broadband, because the governments of the day, all of the governments would have said either, A, you just got to stay at home and do nothing, in which case, as I say, economic collapse, or B, we're going to allow you out to do your job on some kind of restricted basis. But more and more people would have caught the virus and more people would have passed away. So for me, broadband has literally saved economic collapse and or the health system collapse.
If you look at a lockdown even 5-6 years ago, it would have been very different for those reasons. I hadn't considered that actually, that broadband has facilitated the ability to work from home. And really, if we now fast forward, I'm being asked all the time, what's the future of work? And everyone's saying it's hybrid. People don't want to go back 5 days a week. The reason we can even have this discussion is because broadband is there. That's a really interesting point, something I hadn't considered, but it's so obvious. Another thing I want to look at, we talk about digital divide in terms of haves and have-nots, but I want to talk about another thing that's been introduced because of this working from home, and that's cybercrime. Now that more people are at home, I'm seeing the increase of crime being executed online, things like phishing, cryptojacking, and general social engineering. Are you seeing the same?
Yes, I think the bad guys will always follow the money, and if there's a way to illegally take money off particularly naive or innocent or uneducated, they'll always exploit anybody that they can. I think from a corporate point of view, we're seeing a lot more robustness in terms of security being applied, not just in terms of algorithms and the right endpoints on a laptop or on an iPad or whatever, but also in terms of behavioral training. You know, I work for a large multinational, and as well as they provide us with all the appropriate hardware and embedded software within that hardware to keep the bad guys at bay. But they also continually run reality training where the company itself will deliberately send phishing emails, which you're expected to recognize as a phishing attempt, and hopefully you put it in your junk folder and or report it to IT. But if you don't, if you click on it, then you are taken away to do some refresher training. Don't forget, there are bad guys out there. So I think, sadly, it is on the increase. I think, we're hearing constantly of entire companies being shut down for a day or two because the bad guys have gotten in and they're having to clean things up. We had a company over from the Netherlands, actually, last week. We're very big in street furniture, where we put antennas at the top of poles and so on. And this particular company is very good at street furniture, as well as manufacturing cars, as well as manufacturing walk-in showers. I mean, they do everything in the Netherlands, huge company. And they've been shut down for about 6 weeks because they had a cyber attack. And it's all gone very quiet internally. They haven't explained exactly how they're getting out of it. There's light at the end of the tunnel, let's say. And they're all expecting to be back online literally in the next few days. And what they actually said is, if it wasn't for WhatsApp, we would have collapsed because every system had to be shut down. The bad guys had done a very good job from a bad guy's point of view. And it was WhatsApp that kept them all going. And they've been literally trading with each other inside the corporate on WhatsApp for about 6 weeks.
That shows you that single point of failure. If you get hacked, it can be incredibly dangerous. I do a public service announcement in all of my talks about password managers and two-factor authentication. I do a stand-up. I say stand-up if you've got two-factor enabled. And I get annoyed with audiences that don't turn it on. For those listening, if you go to 2fa.directory, it shows you all of the different sites that have got two-factor enabled. I turn on for absolutely everything. And if listeners do nothing else today after listening to this podcast, please, please, please go and turn on two-factor. So we've both been in the telco space for a long time. I cut my teeth with 1G at Optus and 2G at Telstra in the late 90s. Like you, I've also been attending the Mobile World Congress in Barcelona for years. And each year when we're there, the promise is whatever G we're on would be a revolution. So now we're up to 5G. Will we see an acceleration in use cases as the networks get rolled out?
Both with 4G and 5G, the use case seemed to be just faster speeds for the human. 3G was okay, but it was a bit sluggish, let's be honest. Whereas 4G, I find to be generally acceptable for most of the things that I need to do as a human being, because my brain can't work anywhere near as fast as a processor can. So for everything I need to do, 4G is probably fast enough. And 5G, I think, has begun its life really as turbocharged 4G. When you really sit down and think, well, what can a human consume beyond 4G, there's not that much other than perhaps certain applications with 5G where you've got the benefit of low latency. Then yeah, it may be gaming, for example. That low latency is something else that the human can perceive. But for me, we're finally getting into the speeds where it's only the IoT world, the Internet of Things world, whether that thing be something quite powerful like a laptop or something very simple like a security camera or whatever. We're reaching the speeds where it's only the devices that can really exploit the network, whether it's the ultra-reliable low-latency aspect of the network, the high-security aspect of the network, or just the sheer speed that you're going to get from 5G. So, for example, things like augmented reality. When I was at Cisco, we were just getting into broadband at the very beginning. DOCSIS 1.0 was taking off. It was the beginning of DSL. And a colleague of mine who was a visionary, he's an ex-MIT guy who's a strategist for Cisco, he said to me at the time, Phil, it's all about video. That's what's going to be the exponential kicker for bandwidth consumption. Because initially, you know, we just did email and then we had the odd static picture. And even a static picture would take 2 or 3 seconds to download. Then came video. And at that time, I guess, 2G, the mobile internet just wasn't fast enough to use video. So that was, 21 years ago. Now we've got Netflix, Amazon Prime, Sky, all using the internet as its main distribution mechanism. So for video, the internet has finally become robust enough, including the wireless internet as in 4G. But as we get into technologies like augmented reality, like hologram meetings, whereby you know you and I, rather than being on this Zoom interface, we actually have a holographic experience where we feel we are almost in the same room together. Those kinds of applications will consume enormous amounts of bandwidth. And it's a chicken and egg. For most of my career, the software writers have always assumed there was more bandwidth than there was really. So as soon as you took it away from a wired connection, it didn't work because the people at Microsoft or whatever hadn't realized how much bandwidth their app was going to consume. Whereas now, I think the tables have turned completely. We're about to get into a world where there's so much bandwidth, the software guys don't know what to do with it because we've got more bandwidth than any current application needs. But I would use the analogy of electricity. You know, when Faraday first figured out how to generate electricity, it was 1931 or so, and it was nearly 50 years later before the light bulb was invented. So I think we're in a similar situation. I don't think it's going to take 50 years, by the way, but I think we've now invented super fast internet. Whether it's fixed to your home or it's wireless with 5G, everybody's going to get access to that over the next 2 or 3 years. And now the challenge is for the application people to write the apps that will exploit that bandwidth. But believe you me, they will, because humans are very innovative. And I'm sure that although at the minute we don't quite see the need for a personal need for 500 megs wherever you are, I think over the next couple of years, we'll look back and say, yeah, we found a way to use that bandwidth.
I'll have 500 megs wherever I am. Thank you very much. I've got a 5G MiFi, and everywhere I do the same thing. I do speed tests. I think on Vodafone in central London, I've got 350 meg down and about 75 meg up. So Vodafone, lift your game because I want 350 up as well. But I'm a futurist. You mentioned 5G about speed, but I just want to look at another use case, which is you mentioned IoT. And actually, IoT is not about speed, it's about scale. So if you've got billions and billions of connected devices, you might have a device that sits in a lavatory to show whether the door is open or closed. And if you then fit every door with one of those devices, you can then do predictive cleaning because you can then see how often the lavatories are used. Those actually may only transmit at 200 bits per second and may only transmit every 5 minutes. So they don't need the speed. But if you've got a billion devices in central London, you need a system that can connect permanently. So my argument is for IoT use cases, it's about scale, not speed.
No, I would wholeheartedly agree. But if you look at some of the other functionality out of 5G, such as network slicing, it's quite feasible that Vodafone or EE or whoever could slice part of their network and wholesale that out to a security company or a cleaning company that has got those IoT devices. But because the IoT device doesn't, it's not important as you've closed the door for that information to go back to the control center that very millisecond. If it takes 2 or 3 seconds, even a minute, it doesn't matter because it's a cleaning company that reacts in minutes and hours, not in milliseconds. So they can slice that part of the network and sell it to that particular application. But at the same time, there are other applications that do require extremely low latency, such as maybe some kind of telemedicine application, whereby if you were, for argument's sake, literally a remote health worker having to do something with a patient that's a long way away, then it's very important to have that low latency. And so you slice the network accordingly to provide that superior service. And in that context, it makes it more affordable for the operators to dissect their networks and therefore accelerate the whole rollout of all these different types of technologies, but in an affordable way.
The issue is spectrum. That spectrum is finite and it has to be licensed and it's very expensive. And I remember someone talking yesterday about the bragging rights on 5G. So the Three network here in the UK got a contiguous 100 megahertz allocation, which makes life a lot easier than having to chop things around. So I think it'll be he or she who can spend the most on spectrum will win the game at the end. Back to the home setup, I'm not sure if you remember the promise of femtocells. Femtocell is essentially a base station in the home, 3-4G base station connected via internet. I had one from Vodafone in my basement flat some years ago in London because I had bad mobile coverage. Whatever happened to them?
I'll be honest with you, I'm not sure, other than I've got one here in my home office, because where we live down a lane, at reasonably decent broadband, but the wireless signal is awful. The carrier kindly gave me one to connect to my broadband, and it seems to do the job. So as far as I'm aware, from a consumer point of view, they're still being used, and they still fill that niche where the wireless signal is poor and you need a voice link. Although, I don't know about you, what I've noticed is throughout the pandemic, I've used my cell phone less and less, and I've been a lot more on Zoom calls, on Teams calls, on WebEx calls and so on, both internally and externally. Everybody quickly adapted to the new paradigm, and I found that my laptop and my iPad have become the preferred mechanism to talk with people, and the mobile phone gets used now and again, but not a lot, certainly compared to pre-pandemic.
Yeah, someone rang me yesterday. It was a phone call, and I thought, what's that? I haven't had one of those for a while. So back to CommScope and what you're doing. What new innovations will you or are you developing that will help operators drive new services?
On the fixed side, we're a big player in fiber infrastructure, as we said at the very beginning. And the problem that the telcos have now got with rolling out fiber, everybody's woken up to fiber and realized it is the way forward, whether it's because of government prodding or they've just come to that conclusion anyway, that fiber is very much in vogue. And like any mass rollout, you need people to make things happen. And the fiber rollout is a massive civil engineering exercise, if you like. You mentioned earlier on about people digging up the street near you and in Fulham and so on. That's going on throughout the country and throughout the world. So, A, you need civil engineers to do the digging, the literal digging, but then you need telecoms engineers to start to connect the exchanges to the nearest cabinet and then the cabinet into your building, your apartment block and so on. And there are only so many of those engineers to go around, just like there are only so many people to pick Brussels sprouts for Christmas or whatever. What we're doing is we've developed devices whereby you can connect things in the field much more rapidly than generation one, if you like. With generation one, it's a bit like imagine your job is installing televisions on behalf of a large retailer. If when they ship the television comes with a power cord and just two bare wires, and your job as the installer is to take it into somebody's house, get it in position, and then fit the plug and plug it in and make sure it works, that would take a lot longer than if the manufacturer puts a plug on the end in the first place, because you could just put it in position, plug it in, and away you go. Well, our hardened fiber technology is similar. It's made in the factory in a way that the field installers can plug and play very rapidly and then move on to the next piece of their day. Whereas generation one fiber tends to be much more about terminating fiber in the field with the appropriate tools, where you've got to be super clean, super careful, very accurate in terms of the finish and so on. And that takes a lot of time. So what we're doing is helping fiber-based operators roll these things out much more quickly with a limited labor pool. On the wireless side, we've had a lot of conferences lately with all the big wireless players, and they say that 5G is as much about civil construction as it is about technology. And the reason for that is the tower loading in places like America and Australia, they tend to go more for big towers, which are devices almost like mini Eiffel Towers, if you like, that are in concrete on the ground and dot along the highway or in the city. In Europe, because of space, they tend to be a lot more rooftop type environments where the antennas are on the roof and so on. But either way, all of these locations have typically been designed with 2G, 3G, 4G in mind, where the loading at the top of the tower or the top of the roof was less in terms of physical weight of units and in terms of wind load. Because, you know, you can imagine a group of antennas at the top of the building in high winds acts like a kite. There's a fair bit of stress goes onto the steel substructure, and they have to pass local council safety tests and so on and so forth. So as we get into 5G, you've got very heavy new antennas and new radios going up. And that creates a civil engineering challenge in terms of beefing up the rooftop or the tower on the highway. And what we're doing is creating new antennas, passive antennas, that would allow you to still offer the services you're offering at 4G and 3G at the various whatever spectrum allocation you've got as an operator. You can still operate those. And at the same time, behind our passive antenna, in a kind of a ghost footprint, if you like, you can have the active antenna from your OEM, depending on who the active side of your RAN is, for instance, Ericsson or Nokia or whoever. And so by putting in this overlap type of capability, you're reducing the wind load and the weight at the top of the structure, and therefore minimizing the amount of steel re-engineering that you'd have to do to roll out 5G. So from our point of view, we're accelerating the rollout of 5G by having to do less civil engineering than you would if you did what we've done with 2, 3, and 4G, which is just more antennas at the top of the tower.
You might just explain for our listeners what the difference is between active and passive antennas. Not that it's important or we'll be testing people, but I'm intrigued as to what the difference is.
All the way up to 4G, the antennas at the top of the tower are similar to the antenna that you might have used in the old days to get a TV signal. It's just a device for capturing the signal. And dare I say, if you touched it, you wouldn't be electrocuted. It's a passive device. There's no power going to that unit. The latest generation of antennas for massive MIMO are active, and they are part of the whole base station infrastructure. They're controlled by the same software that controls the RAN, and they can pump through a tremendous amount of data. They're tremendously efficient, but they're pretty expensive and they consume a lot of power. And they're pretty heavy. So you would typically use them in downtown London, in South Kensington, near the station, for instance, or in Piccadilly Circus and so on. And in those dense locations, per bit, they become more efficient in terms of per bit carried through the network. In lighter load scenarios, such as more remote parts of even London or certainly parts of Australia, you'd say, why am I powering something for 24 hours a day when there's only three cars a day go past here? I'll go with a passive antenna. And the passive antenna will do the job if the traffic load is lower. And where we fit in is, we bring the legacy 3G, 4Gs to the same site as the new 5G. And it's the 5G active antenna in a busy city centre location that you would typically get from your OEM. And the passive side, we'd complement that on the passive side and marry the two together so that from a wind point of view, it looks like one antenna, when in fact, you've got two quite different technologies in a way sitting in exactly the same footprint.
So final question before we go to a quick fire round, what new products and services do you expect to produce as a result of the pandemic? What have you learned and how well have you adapted?
We haven't stopped innovating though in terms of smaller and faster fiber connectivity. So we have a whole new range of products under the Novix brand, which will accelerate the speed of fiber rollout. And we see the fiber demand way off into the horizon. This isn't a 12, 24-month thing. This is at least 5, 6, 7 years ahead. So smaller, lighter, more nimble on the fiber side. And then on the wireless side, you mentioned it earlier on that some operators were lucky enough to get contiguous spectrum, and their antenna design can tend to be easier because you're only having to align to a whole chunk of spectrum all next to each other, if you like. Whereas most operator histories, they're like roads in Europe. They weren't planned in a grid-like fashion like in the US. They just grew over history. And most operators have got a historical acquisition of spectrum where every time they bought more spectrum, they got different bits of bandwidth versus the time before. And that requires specialist antennas. So for us, it's more and more about working with bespoke antennas with each and every operator in each and every country, which there's a lot of heavy lifting to do that. But it's the only way that the operators are going to be able to provide, you know, full 5G to as many people as they can in, you know, whatever their geography is, where their spectrum license is. So it's continued innovation on that antenna design.
So almost out of time. Let's go for a quick fire round to find out more about Phil. iPhone or Android?
iPhone.
PC or Mac?
PC. Although I wish there was Mac sometimes.
What's the app you use most on your phone?
Ooh, you stumped me. I was going to say WhatsApp, but actually I think Twitter.
What's your Twitter handle?
PSorsky.
What's the one thing you won't be doing again post-pandemic?
Worrying too much about the future.
Well, that's the opposite of me. I have to worry about the future given my job. What are you reading at the moment?
I'm actually reading a book. It's fiction, but it's based on reality about Mexican drug wars.
How do you want to be remembered?
I guess as a fair individual, respect for others, love my family, generally of a cheerful disposition.
As this is the Actionable Futurist podcast, what three actionable things should people be doing now to get themselves ready for 2022 when it comes to digital and communications technology?
So three things. I would say, firstly, check your local telco's intentions regarding future broadband speeds. And if they're not offering at least 100 meg, you might want to consider moving house. Secondly, I would say you need to check your security situation, both from an electronic security in terms of software that can protect you, but also password security. I think Andrew's comments earlier on were absolutely spot on. And thirdly, I guess from a device point of view, you ain't seen anything yet. We're already up to the iPhone 13. I think take a keen interest in new developments from a device point of view, because AR is just around the corner, augmented reality is just around the corner. And I think there's a whole new world that we're going to be able to enjoy.
Phil, some great tips there. How can people find out more about you and your work?
That's easy. Either check me out on LinkedIn. I'm just Phil Sorsky on LinkedIn, or www.comscope.com.
Fantastic. A great discussion today. Nice to speak to another fellow geek who's been involved in telco as long as I have. Thank you so much for your time.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Andrew. It really has.
Thank you for listening to the Practical Futurist podcast. You can find all of our previous shows at futurist.london. And if you like what you've heard on the show, please consider subscribing via your favourite podcast app so you never miss an episode. You can find out more about Andrew and how he helps corporates navigate a disruptive digital world with keynote speeches and C-suite workshops at futurist.london. Until next time, this has been the Practical Futurist Podcast.